Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Now, my first guest this morning is an award-winning journalist with 50 years' experience in the news business. He started in local papers before moving on to local radio and then television news, where he spent 40 years working for the BBC, ITN, and most recently, Sky News. In that time, he reported on some of the biggest news stories of modern times, from Tiananmen Square to Nelson Mandela's journey from prison to president. He also covered the first Gulf War, the war in Rwanda, the Balkan conflict, the 2003 Iraq War, and ran news bureau in Asia, Africa, and North America. Now, after a lifetime telling other people's stories, he's finally telling his own in a fascinating new book called Breaking News. Jeremy Thompson, good morning and welcome to Talk Radio Europe.
Very good to see you, Sean. Thank you very much for having me along.
Well, you're very welcome. What brings you to Spain?
I've got a place just up the road from here. I can almost see your studio windows from where I've got a holiday home, which we use pretty regularly, so I'm just down here for the week. I'm coming and going at the moment, but my main home still London, but I love the weather and I love the people and I love everything about
it. It is irresistible here, so. Here, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Good. Yeah, it's 2 degrees at home, 20 degrees here. It's not, it's a clear-cut argument.
That's exactly why I'm here, for the vitamin D. So let's look back. I mean, an extraordinary career. Where did it all begin? Why did you want to be a journalist?
I think, like most journalists, it's usually because you're nosy and curious, and your mum would say you ask far too many questions, and eventually you find yourself drawn to going to journalism. But, I mean, back in the 60s, when I left school and started it, it wasn't really seen as a terribly seemly sort of profession. In fact, my dad, who was, you know, pretty solid citizen and a man of insurance who'd gone to work in the 1920s when tough times were tough, and his only instruction for me was get a regular job with a good pension and a steady salary and you'll be all right. So he was horrified that I wanted to be a journalist. In fact, I remember him saying to me, "You can't be a journalist. Do you realise there's only one worse insurance risk than a journalist? And that's a jazz musician." I mean, it was like the lowest of the low. So he really wasn't a great approver of me going into it. But I was determined to. Got an apprenticeship as a teenager on a local paper, the Cambridge News, and set off from there. And really thought I'd be going to Fleet Street if I was good enough. And suddenly local radio opened up. And intriguingly, it's the 50th anniversary this week of BBC local radio starting up. And not far off 50 years ago, about 46 years ago, I started at Radio Sheffield and got a chance there. And for a lot of us of my generation who thought you'd never get access to big grown-up BBC or ITN television, got a chance to go in on the ground floor of a new venture in local radio. And I then went on to regional telly in Leeds at Look North and then got picked up by network telly and started as a network TV correspondent. And that was what I did for the next 40 years.
Let's wind back to the newspaper, the first newspaper you said in Cambridge. What kind of a job was that? What did it involve?
Well, your apprenticeship, they called it an indenture in those days, had a four-year apprenticeship, and pretty much you didn't quite scrub the floors, but you basically wiped down the desktops and you started with birth, deaths and marriages. You know, you always wonder who writes them. Well, it's the poor junior who does that. Me being the junior, did that for about a year or so. You know, this sort of mountain of pro formas that were coming on Friday from the loving mums and dads of the brides and bridegrooms-to-be. And you have to write up, you know, this, try and turn it into wonderful prose, the fact that, you know, the accountant is marrying the sales clerk or whatever, and you've got to kind of build it into a bit of a drama. And then Monday, I remember the slog, you had to check them all, because, of course, if you don't check them, what happens? There's bound to be one of them that didn't happen, which then becomes a better story.
Oh, I hadn't even
There's
thought of that.
There's an amazing number of weddings that don't happen.
At the last minute.
Well, the bridegroom gets a bit too close to the, you know, the matron of honour, the, you know, the somebody walks out, somebody drops the, you know, the bouquet, something happens, or one of them's ill. It's amazing how many times in those days that you'd ring up on a Monday morning and say, so did the wedding of Miss Smith to Mr. Brown go ahead, and they go, long story there, but no, it didn't. You go, right, get my notepad out, and
Fantastic.
You've got a great story. So you kind of learn the trade of journalism. You know, no news is bad news, they say.
Did you, in that period when you were, you know, going through those week after week after week, did you ever think, oh, is this really what I want to be doing?
I think the times when I thought, is this what I want to be doing, when you'd go up, I mean, we used to type on enormous great cast iron typewriters that people will remember from those days that weighed a ton, and you had a kind of huge glorified toilet roll coming out the back with two lots of carbon and three sheets of paper. The top one was the story, the second one was the check copy, the third one went on your spike on your desk so that you had a record of it, and you would literally walk the length of the room to the news editor's desk and you'd hand him your story as the junior. And then for the first year, I guess about 4 out of 10 stories, he would just rip up in front of my face and go, have another go, son. And you learnt the hard way, you know, if he didn't like it, you'd say, well, what's wrong with it? You'll figure it out, boy.
I love the sound of the physicality of the newsrooms in those days, because, I started 35 years ago in radio, and there were, you know, great big clunking typewriters. They were noisy, busy places. Where now you walk into a newsroom and it can almost be an insurance office.
Yes. No, I referred to them now as newsrooms as processing plants. Quite often people buy folk who could be doing almost any other thing. I'm not, you know, I don't necessarily see or feel that electric buzz of a newsroom always. Whereas in those days, you know, a big story comes in and you just feel it. There's a buzz, you know, everybody's up for it. And out the back, just through a door, is great. There were great clunking presses, you know, hammering out the evening paper. There was, yeah, you're right, there was noise, there was smell to it, there was texture to it, there was a lot of excitement about the whole process of news, you know. And when the news editor finally thought, you know, he'd beaten you down enough, trusted you to go out in a story, and he said, you know, right, there's been an accident, a murder, something's happened. You, son, out there. I want the story. You phone it in 2 hours' time. It was a real excitement, a real buzz.
And even that, the idea of phoning in a story where somebody would take down the copy, where now, of course, you just send it on your phone or text it or whatever.
2p bits in the phone box. I mean, one of the things I write about in the book is at one stage I got sent out to one of the district offices, which was in Ely. Now, I'd always been a rugby man. I was a bit frustrated at not being able to play. So I thought, well, I'm far enough away from headquarters that I maybe can slip in and play for the local rugby side. So I started doing that. But I also had to do the preview on the Friday for Friday's paper. And then I had to report the match I was playing in, which obviously threw up a few obstacles. So what happens is I'd take my notebook with me, get changed, run out in the field, then I'd look around and try and find somebody, you know, one of the subs or anybody was injured or, you know, a friendly face, you know, somebody's mum or dad. And you'd say, please, I've marked out the page, please jot down any of the scores like that. And at halftime, I'll run off and I'll write 200 words. And here's a 2p. Could you go and phone this number? And they'd phone copy in, which worked great for most of a season until we went out to some incredibly remote rugby ground in the Wash called West Norfolk, I think, which was outside King's Lynn, where there was nothing apart from a farmhouse a mile away. And the only bloke who could do it was our scrum half, who was not the brightest in the book. He was a farm lad, and he also had a broken leg, so he had a cast and crutches, and I had to write it all in capital letters and send him off to the farmhouse. So this poor lad with a broken leg and crutches climbing over farm gates and fences to go to a farm. He got back about in full time, you know, took him the whole of the second half to phone over copy. And then eventually, at the end of that season, I ran out the changing rooms at Ely, and who's standing in front of me but the editor, who happened to be a Cambridgeshire County rugby selector. He said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, well, I'm playing rugby, sir." But you're supposed to be reporting. "Oh, I'm doing that as well, sir." So, "Well, get back in the changing room. You're not supposed to be playing." Anyway, I said, "Well, you wouldn't want me to let the team down, would you?" So in the end, I said to him, "Well, if it's all right for me to play, could you write the notes?" So I got the editor of my paper writing the notes and going off at half-time with a 2p bit to phone over copy. I got hauled in the next Monday and they put an end to it. So, can't do that again.
So Fleet Street, presumably at that point, was the dream.
Yeah,
did you want to be a crime writer or a was there anything in particular?
Just general sort of hotshot reporter, you know, ideally with a trilby hat and a trench coat, you know, with press stuck in the band of the trilby hat. But and out in Cambridge, there were a lot of the regional reporters for the national papers who were very good at supplying beer if you supplied stories. So you'd get the stories from your newspaper and give them, tip them the wink and say, "It's a great story coming up in tonight's paper. You might want it for yours." They'd turn it into a fantastic spread for the Express, the Mail, the Mirror. And we'd get free pints in lieu of that. So I got to know them well, and I was thinking, I want to be like them. I want to go down to Fleet Street and do all the big stories and maybe one day travel. And then local radio started up, and somebody said, "Well, you've got a decent voice. Why don't you pop into local radio?" So I changed everything.
But local radio nearly didn't happen, did it?
No.
Because you didn't realise you'd got the job.
No, I mean, it was real old days of BBC. I was on the paper. I went up and did an interview at Radio Sheffield. And about 3 months later, I still heard nothing, so I assumed I hadn't got the job. So I rang up Human Resources, as it was called in those days, and the Personnel Department.
Pre-HR.
Yeah. Personnel Department, and said, "Jeremy Thompson here, just wondering, you know, I obviously didn't get that job, but if you give me any pointers as to where I came up short." And this charming, quite elderly man in personnel said, oh God, aren't you there?" I said, "No, should I be?" He said, "Oh yeah, no, you got the job." He said, "Oh God, I think I must have forgotten to tell you." And it turned out that he was about in his 50s and he'd had a tragic story of his wife dying sort of prematurely. And years later, he'd fallen in love. And as he said to me, "Well, it just sort of took my attention away." And he'd got married and gone off on honeymoon and forgotten that he was supposed to be telling me about the job. So eventually he said, well, "Can you be there tomorrow?" I said, "No, I can't. I have to give notice." Anyway, eventually I got to work at Radio Sheffield, despite the nice old bloke in personnel who got it all wrong. So, yes, you're right. It nearly didn't happen at all.
So Radio Sheffield must have been one of the earlier stations in the
I think
it
was
network.
In the first three or four, yeah.
So that must have been quite a pioneering time, or there must have been quite a pioneering spirit within the station.
It was fantastic. And it was also a fascinating news time. I mean, I joined in 71, had about 3 years there nearly. And bear in mind, I mean, if you cast your mind back or if you read the history books at the time, what was going on was basically what it retrospectively was the beginning of the end of the Industrial Revolution. So even then, there were the first round of miners' strikes. I had to deal with Arthur Scargill of the National Union of Mine Workers every other day. There were the flying pickets, you know, the miners' teams who went in to shut down Saltley Coke Depot in Birmingham. There were the, you know, electricity plants were being brought to a halt. There were strikes everywhere throughout all the industries because they were feeling under threat. And, of course, it brought down the Heath government in the early 70s. There was the three-day week, which was, you know, we were literally editing like you were, but with candlelight.
Yeah.
You know, trying to edit our tapes in the middle of the night by candlelight because there was no electricity. And we were wearing about four layers because it was freezing cold and there was no heating anywhere. And then the Wilson government came in and, I mean, it was fascinating times. There was, I remember just as a southern lad standing on picket lines outside coal mines that I'd never seen before, and huge steelworks in Sheffield in the grandeur of the steel industry there, where I was roundly known as, oh, look, it's that Southern Jesse. I was round it, so everybody knew, oh, yeah, it's that Southern Jesse, come to find out what it's like in the hard knoll. Dark satanic mills, lad. So I got wound up pretty, relentlessly for quite a long time, which was a good hardening up process, a southern lad up north.
Yes. And how was Arthur Scargill? Was he as fiery as he appeared?
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, a very impressive bloke. I mean, a tricky old bloke for the governments to deal with and for the industry to deal with, but actually a very impressive bloke. I mean, a self-taught miner who'd come out the pits and ended up going into the union to represent workers and, basically through his dynamism, he'd risen to the up through the ranks and became an enormously powerful figure. So he was an intriguing person to go and see at his Barnsley headquarters, where he'd sort of hold court. It was Arthur's Castle, as it was known, literally Arthur Tales of the Round Table, the Arthur's Castle and Arthur's Court. And, we watched this extraordinary drama, this industrial drama, this battle of strength between politicians, those who ran the industries, the big industries of the country, and the unions, who were probably at their most powerful during those 70s and early 80s, up to the last big coal strike, miner strike in the mid 80s. But I dealt with the ones in the 70s, which were pretty feisty affairs, and there were plenty of battles on the picket lines, and it was tough.
Well, we'll come on to television in just a moment, but during those radio years, did you ever look back? Did you ever think, actually, there's still something about the press that interests me, or had the radio bug bitten you?
No, definitely the radio bug had bitten. I mean, I still loved the writing process, which I must say I sort of came all the way back to writing the book, and I found I still loved the idea of sitting down and writing stories. But no, definitely bitten by the radio bug. There's something... There is, as you know, I mean, a real joy in putting together word pictures, painting pictures without pictures, which is how I learnt my trade, that I then grafted on to television later on. But the whole idea of conjuring up for people a picture of what's going on through your words and the sounds that you use around you was a skill in its own right. And, I really enjoyed that, the finding the craft and actually crafting pieces on air. Mind you, we did a bit of everything. I mean, not only crafted audio packages for the news, but we present the news bulletins, we do the current affairs show, we do the quiz shows. I did the sports show quite often on Saturday afternoon. On Sunday afternoon, you could be in charge of the entire station, so you ran the news desk, and then you put on the two-way family favourites local radio version from midday onwards and all that sort of thing. And then you'd nod off, and then somebody would ring in and say, oh, there's nothing on air, lad, what's going on? And you'd rush up and the old deck would be spinning round with the tail out of a bit of tape, and you'd have to feed it back in and scramble to the microphone going, terribly sorry, we've had a slight technical difficulty there. I'm sure you're now all hearing us properly. The usual... The cutting your teeth in local radio, as they say.
You're listening to TRE. Sean Bolger here until 12. And in this hour of the programme, my guest is Jeremy Thompson, award-winning journalist with 50 years' experience in the news business. You'll know him from the BBC, ITN, and most recently, Sky News. Jeremy, we were talking a moment ago about radio. You were in Radio Sheffield, BBC Radio Sheffield, in the early days. Television then came calling, presumably within the BBC, a chance to jump over to television. Did you need much convincing?
No, not really. I wasn't quite sure how it all worked, but the local station was Look North Leeds, of which there were three Look Norths, Newcastle, Leeds and Manchester. And there was a bit of crossover between staff, and somebody from Leeds sort of gave me a ring one day and said, do you want to try out as a reporter on TV? And I said, yeah, I'll give it a go. And so they sent a crew down and we went off on a story, and I did a couple of pieces for them, and they said, well, you seem to know what you're doing. Here's a job. So I didn't take that much persuading. I thought, this is quite entertaining. I'll give telly a go, you know. I mean, my view about my career is really nothing ventured. You really don't know what's coming up next. I'd gone into newspapers thinking I'd always be there. Radio came up, and I thought, oh, I'll give that a try. And then telly came up, and I thought, oh, well, why not, you know? So followed my nose and did the next thing in front of me, and it's been 50 years of that, really.
I mean, it strikes me now that the people in the media that I meet, and younger people in the media, have aspirations. They know straight away they want to be on television. But it kind of just happened organically for you.
It did. And I find I occasionally get a little bit depressed at the thought when, you know, the last few years working at Sky in the newsroom and youngsters coming up for a sort of, you know, one of those look-sees. Maybe they've come in as a runner or they've come in from college to have a look round. And you say, well, what do you want to do? And they say, well, I want to do what you do. And you say, I'd say, well, what do you think I do? Well, you're on telly. And I said, well, yeah, not really the point. I'm first and foremost a journalist who ended up on television, and really I'm a reporter who, years and years down the line, after being a foreign correspondent and everything else, ended up as a presenter and roaming correspondent. Ah, no, we just want to be on telly.
Yeah.
So it appears that the sort of celebrity of being on telly has at times taken over people's target. You know, they're not thinking, I want to be a journalist. They're thinking, I just want to be on telly because it's a cool thing to do in 2016-17, which is a shame. And I hope in the end they find, you know, that they really want to make a proper career out of it. Because they tend to say, so how long does it take you to get on the telly and be a presenter? And I'd say, well, about 30 years.
Yeah, I bet they're not too pleased to hear
that.
Well,
just to make them, you know, think.
Well, you moved from, obviously, regional television into national television relatively quickly.
In 1977, I'd been doing local telly for about 2.5 years. The BBC decided, in its wisdom, Network TV News, that they ought to have a North of England TV correspondent, because ITN had had one for a few years, which had been quite a good success story. So the Beeb thought it was, you know, getting caught short a bit on some of the big stories, so decided to have a North of England correspondent. I very luckily put in for that and got that job. So I became North of England correspondent and sort of part of Scotland correspondent, and pretty much because metro-centric BBC news execs sitting in the Spur in White City, as it was then, really didn't know much before, much beyond Leicester Forest East. So really I had the Midlands, the North of England and half of Scotland to do in a very bright blue staff Cortina with the first mobile phone.
Wow.
Which actually took up most of the car. It was the most ginormous thing. And I could only get reception on it by driving up to the top of the Pennines or up into the Lake District. It was useless. Or up onto Ilkley Moor, near where I lived. So, but I got this old phone going. But I had a good few years up there and some great stories. And it was in those days that one or two big stories broke. I mean, there were things like the Cod Wars, there were more industrial disputes. But perhaps the biggest thing was the Yorkshire Ripper, which was an extraordinary story. That took 5 years for police to track him down, in which time he'd killed, you know, over a dozen women. And I remember having those North versus South debates with the newsroom in London about when am I going to get a story on the 9 o'clock news about the Yorkshire Ripper? And they go, oh, well, it's a very regional story, old boy. And I was saying, well, how many women do you want this man to kill before you take it seriously? Which finally won the argument, but he'd probably kill 4 or 5 before national news woke up to it and I started getting on. And then the story became the dominant story of the next few years, and all the way through to when he was caught and then went to trial at the Old Bailey, which I came down to cover as well. And there was another big story at the time, which was the Black Panther, who was also another multiple murder case.
Was that Leslie Whittle?
Yes. Yeah. He was a little bloke with a big problem, big chip on his shoulder. He lived in Bradford, and he thought he was better and cleverer than most, and he really, really aspired to be a sort of special forces soldier. But he was too small and would never be taken seriously. So he'd go yomping off up the Pennines dressed in military gear, and then started knocking over post offices, and eventually killed a sub-postmaster and sub-postmistress. And then his big plan was to kidnap Leslie Whittle, who was a teenage girl whose dad owned quite a big coach transport company in the West Midlands. And he kidnapped her and hid her in a drainage system near Kidsgrove, Wolverhampton Way in the West Midlands. And somehow or another, she died. Whether he pushed her, he put a ligature around her throat. It was a pretty gruesome story. They eventually caught him, almost more by luck than judgment, outside a fish and chip shop in Mansfield. But again, I remember doing the trial in the late 70s. They actually have the trial in Oxford because he was so notorious that they felt he wouldn't get a fair trial in West Yorkshire. So those two, what were huge crime stories at the time, very dominant crime stories, were a big part of what I did in the late 70s, early 80s.
I mean, presumably, going back to the story about the Yorkshire Ripper, getting the airtime on the news was more difficult because there wasn't quite so much news time on television in those days.
No, there wasn't quite so much news time, and as said, for London-centric news desks, the North was still a bit of a mystery, I think. So there was a bit of that as well.
Do you think now, because we have rolling news now, of course, on several channels, including Sky and BBC News, which I think was 20 yesterday, do you think the fact that we have rolling news has actually diluted the impact of the message? Because there's more time to fill, so it's about comment, it's about speculation and reaction, rather than reporting events that have happened?
Probably has blurred it somewhat. I mean, because of regulation, because of Ofcom, that the regulator that oversees broadcasting in the UK, in the broadcast media, you still have to play it straight down the middle, which I was always proud of. I always felt that was my object in life, was to tell a story independently, objectively and fairly, and present the facts to people for them to make up their own mind. But you're right, the evolution of television, rolling television news and rolling radio news, is that it has become much more of talking shops. So there's much more comment and chat, not necessarily by the presenters, that's still deemed not right under the Ofcom rules, but there's no doubt that, you know, unless the big story crops up at school and at Sky and they clear the decks, which was always the policy there, in between, on the quieter days, there's an awful lot of babble about not very much.
All right, we'll talk some more in just a moment. Jeremy Thompson is our guest this morning. He's written a book called Breaking News, telling the story of his 50-year career in the news business. Jeremy, we're almost out of time. We mentioned earlier on that you've done the Iraq War, the Rwandan conflict, the Balkan conflict. At any point, have you ever lost faith in humanity because of the things you've seen?
Not quite, but been pushed a few times. I mean, the genocide in 94 in Rwanda was pretty gruesome. When you're seeing people die on a massive scale, that's quite hard to come to terms with, as was the civil war in Somalia, which was bloody and vicious and nasty and created man-made famine, and then you see people dying unnecessarily simply because the warlords are fighting out their own power struggle. And food becomes leverage, which is a horrible thing to see. And the very basic of human rights is to have a meal is taken away from you because people are literally playing with your lives to hold on to power. And those things are quite hard to square away.
But can you square it then by saying, well, I have to be here to tell people about this?
Yes, I think, I mean, the old argument, the old debate that one has as a journalist, which comes up in a few places in the book, I think, is you get somewhere, you see people dying, your first instinct is, can I do anything to save them? And I'm not a medic, I'm not a first aider, I can do CPR and basic things like that. But in the end, as a journalist, I would always tell myself that the powerful thing I can do and the most useful thing is to tell these people's story and to get it out to the widest possible audience, so somebody else will bring pressure, hopefully, to change the situation.
Well, you can read that story and many more besides in Breaking News, an autobiography by Jeremy Thompson. It's out now, published by Bite Back. And as always, you can order your copy online through the TRE bookshop at talkradioeurope.com. Jeremy Thompson, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Good luck with the book and thank you very much for joining us at Talk Radio.
My pleasure. No, thanks for having me in.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.